This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Charles Marone. He runs the organization Strong Towns. Charles, it's great having you on.
Hey, thanks, Robert. Very nice to be here.
And I'm also joined with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Charles. It's nice to talk
to
you. Charles, tell us about yourself. How did you start the organization Strong Towns?
I didn't actually set out to start the organization. I'm a civil engineer who, after 5 years of working and getting my license, went back to graduate school and got a planning degree. And I worked for over a decade doing planning. I actually started my own planning company. And as part of that process, really as part of the 2008 kind of meltdown, which really screwed my company and put us in a tailspin, and did so in like a really frustrating way. I had been out talking to the cities that I work with saying, look, I didn't call the housing bubble, but I was saying like, look, none of this makes any sense. The developments we're doing, the infrastructure we're installing, like all this is just financially losers. Like none of this makes any sense. We need to do something different, and nobody wanted to hear it. And so
these
the time,
are kind of like sprawl type developments you're working on.
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, it's exclusively what it was. And you know, I'm telling these guys like, you know, we can't do this stuff. Like this doesn't make any sense. And you know, the feedback that I would get is like, look, just, you know, we're making money. Shut up and keep doing the job we hired you to do, which is to process these permits and you know, do this stuff. So by the time we got to 2008, I felt like a lone voice in the wilderness, and I really felt very kind of isolated and alone. And my response to that, I mean, I live in a small town in central Minnesota. My response to that was to just start writing. And I thought if I write, I'm going to figure out some of these thoughts that have been, you know, messing around in my head. And, you know, I'm going to publish them on a blog, and we'll see if there's anybody out here who thinks like this. And it was, you know, in very short order, it was rather explosive. And that blog grew into a nonprofit, which has grown into this Strong Towns movement, which is, you know, international movement. We have got almost a million different readers this year. And it's, you know, something I didn't set out to do, but I'm just astounded at where it's come.
Would you say the Strong Towns movement, is it part of a new urbanism?
You know, I am inspired by the new urbanists, and I have spent a lot of time with the new urbanists. I think that the primary insight that they had that I found the most helpful was their kind of going back to the pre-automobile development pattern and questioning why did this work? Like what was it about this that made sense? And so in that sense, I'm really kind of grounded in the early new urbanist insights. I wouldn't call Strong Towns a new urbanist organization. We've got some overlap, but not a lot. But I personally have drawn a lot of inspiration from them.
You have a book out. It's called Thoughts on Buildings and Strong Towns, Volume 2, and this is your second edition to your first edition. Can you talk about your recent book and your original book?
Yeah. You know, I part of when I started writing the blog, I actually thought in my mind, I want to write a book. Writing a book is a large undertaking, especially when you're, you know, in a topic like this that everybody knows so well, yet is kind of technical also. And so I part of writing the blog was to get those thoughts out in kind of an organized way. And I got to the point where I wasn't really ready to write the book, like the, you know, what I think I would call today, like a Strong Towns manifesto type book. But I had enough stuff that people were asking for and referencing that I thought it would be helpful to put it in a book format. And so what I really did with the first volume is take the best stuff that I had written on the blog and put it into a post. I follow that up, you know, this last year. We have a lot more contributors, a lot more writers now at Strong Towns. And so we took work from, I think, 8 or 9 of us and put that in a second volume, you know, edited these pieces, expanded on them, provided more reference material and you know, made them worthy of being in a book. So It is. I like to describe it as like a 101. It is an overview of the best of what you've got at Strong Towns. If you, if you want to go through, we've written, 8 years worth of content, hundreds of thousands of words, maybe millions of words at this point. But if you just want the highlights and get up to speed real quick, there's a couple books out there you can grab and get you going.
If there was one core message at a Strong Towns that you want to get across, what would you say that is?
That's really a good question and kind of a tough one, because I tend to go back and forth and emphasize different things. Right now, I've had this obsession in 2016 with incremental development, the idea that traditional development patterns grew incrementally. And one of the big things we struggle with is that we have a hard time working in increments. We tend to build things in large blocks to a finished state. But I think if I went way back and if I actually, sat down and looked at the core of our message, it's that the investments we make have to make financial sense. And not only they have to make financial sense now, today, they have to make financial sense in the future. A lot of what we built, we build now transactionally, which, we can cash flow these investments. We get a developer to come in and put in the sewer and the water. We get the federal government to come in and build the interchange. We get the state government to come in and help us with a frontage road. And all these things make for a good transaction because we get, at the local level, a lot of growth. But what we also do is take on these long-term liabilities. We make all these promises that we're going to go back and fix and maintain and repair all this stuff. What doesn't make financial sense when you look at it over multiple generations is that long-term promise. The wealth that is created with that new growth and development is never even, marginally close enough to actually make good on all those promises.
Especially the suburban sprawl model is a lot more fiscally unsustainable than a more compact, walkable model.
It is. And I think it is, it's a little simplistic to stop there, but I think if you just stopped there, that would be a true equation. I mean, anytime, and this is the engineer in me, anytime you take a tax base and spread it out over a broader area, you just, by definition, have less revenue and more expense, per foot, per mile, per block, however you want to measure it. I do think urban areas, though, when they tend to build in that same way in large chunks to a finished state, tend to wind up with a lot of the same things. Large parking lots, very low returning investments, buildings that don't kind of breathe and evolve and change over time. So yeah, walkable neighborhoods are in general more financially productive than non-walkable. Neighborhoods that are built incrementally over time and can evolve and change and respond and adapt are going to be more resilient and more productive than ones that don't.
And that's generally been the case of older cities. They've sort of evolved over time with the incremental development.
Yeah,
that's more of an issue than the scale, whether it's a big city or a small city, a dense city or a low density, that you're saying that's the key issue.
There's no doubt about it. And I think, I've drawn a lot from ecology and people who have studied ecological systems and also from the work that has really descended from Charles Darwin. I mean, the idea of evolution. We often look at humans as apart from those kind of systems. We don't count ourselves among the species who evolve. Yet when we look at the places that we inhabit, for thousands and thousands of years prior to our recent automobile experiment, prior to that, we can see a certain form of human habitat that evolved along with us. And when I say evolved, I mean the cities look very similar around the world up until the early 1900s. The building styles will be different, the architecture will be different, but the essential layout, the design, the spacing between different types of things you would do on a normal day, these are things we see regardless of continent, regardless of latitude, regardless of culture. And so what you have in that situation is an approach that is kind of highly tuned to who we are as people. And not just who we are as people in terms of how we want to live, but in terms of our culture and our sociology and our physiology and our politics and our economics. I'm not going to suggest that cities prior to, you know, 1915 were wonderful places. They certainly weren't. They had a lot of problems. They had a lot of things they struggled with. But when you actually examine them, a lot of the things that we struggle with today in terms of class, in terms of economic gaps, in terms of the gap between the rich and the poor, in terms of things like how we maintain our cities, how we, you know, interact with each other, a lot of these things were solved or dealt with or had mechanisms for dealing with in traditional cities that today we just kind of slide right over. So yeah, I would say in general, systems that have feedback and that are able to respond and adapt are going to be more successful financially, more resilient than those that can't. And largely what we built post-World War II are systems that don't respond and don't adapt.
Can you give some examples of cities that have been successful at incremental development and cities that have been failures in doing so?
I think, and the simple answer to your question is that we can go back to any city built prior to, the current experimental way to build. I mean, really current, before the Great Depression. And you would have cities fail often. I mean, we built thousands of cities across this country. Lots of them failed. But what happened is they failed in the early stages. They were a little series of pop-up shacks out on the Great Plains somewhere, and not enough people moved there, and that place just died. And the place, 6 miles up the road, started out the same way, and lots of people moved there, and those places were successful. You can step back and say, why? Why the difference? And my answer as a strong towns advocate would be, we don't really know. The complex variables that make a place work. The right people in the right place at the right time with the right attitude and the right amount of financing and the right ideas all came together to form this place that worked. So you can look at any city, and even though they would have times that were good and times that were bad, they would have, even Rome was sacked, multiple times. It didn't go away. It rebounded. It was resilient. It was adaptable. There were ways to make it work. When we step back and now look today, what we see is that the way we go about building creates a lot of growth in a short period of time, but is really fragile over the long term, creates a lot of liabilities and a lot of promises that we're just unable to make. And so we start to see cities fail, and I would point in North America to cities like Detroit and Flint. I would also point to cities like San Bernardino and Stockton, that are failing in different ways, but cities that are unable to meet their basic obligations to have a fire department and have a police department to, protect the public health, safety, and welfare, because they've grown in a way that has robbed them of their wealth and their resources and their ability to do those things. So I think in general, there's a lot we can learn from those I say automobile, it's not the automobile, because we can adapt our systems to the automobile today and I think do it well. But really the pre kind of big centralized top-down growth model of development.
And there's been a big infrastructure projects throughout history, like going back to like the Roman aqueducts.
Yeah, but you look at the Roman aqueducts, and no one went and built the Roman aqueducts in the hopes that someday you would get Rome, right? They built Rome. Rome was cruising right along, doing really well. And then they said, you know what? We got enough people here. We can put in some aqueducts, and that'll work real well. So what we have done here in the United States today is we've reversed that. We looked at Rome, and we said, hey, Rome had aqueducts. Rome had a Colosseum. What we really need is a bunch of water pipe and a fancy, stadium, and our city will be great. And in Rome, it was the exact opposite. The city was great, and then they were able to do those things because of that. So I think that's a really important distinction, because we've nostalgized the kind of field of dreams notion of build it and they will come. And really, when we look at the way cities build wealth, it has never been that way throughout all of history. It has always been build the place, and then you're going to be able to do those other things you want to do.
And it's also interesting to look at kind of how cities are zoned. On one extreme, you get a city like Washington, D.C., which is like almost perfectly planned out by a city planner. And then the other extreme is cities like Houston and Dallas, which have a lot of sprawl, and they have very loose zoning laws, and they have a lot of problems. The most successful cities seem to be somewhere in between. Cities like Boston or San Francisco, and even New York, even though those places are expensive, they evolved organically over time, but then once they evolved, they put in stricter zoning laws. So there seems to be problems on both extremes of like extreme planned out cities and cities that have no zoning or planning whatsoever.
See, I would take a city like Washington, D.C., and I would group it in with a place like Savannah, Georgia, or Charleston, or even Boston and New York City to a degree, because they were built on a framework. When L'Enfant designed Washington, D.C., the idea was not to prescribe everything that would happen. It was to create a framework whereby essentially the city would evolve over time. You can think of it in like biological terms as creating like a structure that then things could grow on and grow around. And that's a pretty like common biological thing when we're doing, organically growing things. You create the lattice, you create the structure, and then things grow around it. I would put on the other end of the spectrum cities like Kansas City, Omaha. You can go out further west and look at Denver or even Los Angeles to a degree. And what you see there is that the cities have grown horizontally in a horizontal expansion. There's no framework where things evolve over time. It's more cookie cutter, like a stamp. Like we go out and we stamp a subdivision. Phoenix is a great example. We just stamp a subdivision in place, put it in, and then move on and stamp the next one and the next one and the next one and the next one. And there's no sense given to the idea that once something is in place, it would change or evolve over time. That to me is the big difference. And Houston is fascinating because a lot of Houston is built in this old framework, and a lot of Houston continues to evolve and change. A lot of it is just as bad as the stuff you see outside of Atlanta or Phoenix or what have you. But a lot of Houston really works well and has been able to adapt and change over time. So I think it kind of transcends. I always like to say, if you're like left of center, you can build a strong town consistent with your values. If you're right of center, you can build a strong town consistent with your values. It really is not we should have zoning or not have zoning. We should subsidize businesses or not. We should build, it really is more about the way you go about putting things together incrementally and allowing them to evolve and change and adapt over time.
And with the whole sort of left of center, right of center thing, I think it's like the special interest maybe cares about issues like whether it's a chamber of commerce or a special interest group on the left, but your average person's not really thinking about the ideological impact of it. They're just thinking of what's a nice place to live.
I think that's very true. When we get down, it's bizarre because I did so many council meetings, for years when I was doing engineering and planning work. And it was always just depressing and bizarre to me that when we get down to the local level, most people become non-ideological. Most people, when they show up at a meeting to talk about their road or their street, they don't bring their deep ideology to the table. They lose that dogmatic. But a lot of times, just because of who they are, our council members or our regional politicians will be those dogmatic people. And it was very frustrating to watch. Regular people show up and want to have a real conversation about their road or their street. And then all of a sudden you get these people who are very, either are hardcore Fox News people or hardcore MSNBC people, have kind of mapped out their spot and they responded to these very, pragmatic, social, concerns at the local level with this ideological framework. And I don't think it does us much service. I think if we went the other way and actually just, kept our cities, non-ideological in a sense, what we would find is that people can solve a lot of problems. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of common ground when we get to the block, the neighborhood, and really the city level.
It's interesting. Around my neighborhood, it's kind of a suburban area around Philadelphia. Actually, micro apartments have been appearing in the area. And if you know something about, you know, micro apartments, they're kind of like influence from like the Japanese apartments in Tokyo, where it's like only one or two people can live with them. And it's kind of this hip and urban thing up and coming. I mean, I'm just amazed that, you know, where I am is it's kind of like a suburbs, but it's really close to Philadelphia. And yet micro apartments are peering around the area as if it's going to become another city borough or something. So are there going to be more micro apartments in the future, or at least some kind of form of housing which only fits one person at a time, but seems to be very of it seems like it's like an open-ended, like wealthy thing, but it's actually quite a round of just keeping people in like hives or something.
Yeah. What you really have right now today is this complete mismatch between the people who need housing and the housing that's available. You know, two-thirds of households in this country are single-person households. You know, when the census goes out and says, you know, how many people are in your household, two out of three households are saying one person. Whether that is a young person who, you know, is not married or doesn't have a family larger than themselves, or whether that is an elderly person who is, for whatever reason, you know, either widowed or divorced or what have you. But two-thirds of our households are single-person households. Two-thirds of our housing, on the other hand, is multi-person housing. You know, it's housing with two, three, four bedrooms. It's housing for families.
If you look at a new construction that's getting built, what is the breakdown?
Oh, I think it's almost, I think it's, you know, in, unless you're in kind of an odd situation, like the one Pillar describes in the Philadelphia area, you know, if you're out in the broad swath of America, it's almost exclusively single family, you know, multi-person kind of households. It is hard to get financing for single individual places. It really is.
It seems also true that micro apartments are also appearing near wealthy places. I know near the Valley Forge Casino, that's where Donald Trump spoke near in my area. There are actually, I think the King of Prussia Mall is near there, and there's actually micro apartments around there because it seems to be the center of where everyone goes shopping, but in between the area of you getting to Philadelphia. And also, if I was to say, like, if there's a political rally, it's at Valley Forge Casino, where it seems to be, like, the gated communities where there's Philadelphia, where everyone goes in from, you know, the old city's use, but all the micro apartments are off of Philadelphia, but then everyone who goes to work goes back in Philadelphia. So there's this kind of dichotomy between working class and upper class, but the upper class has this strange, I don't know how to really describe it, but
It's interesting because what you are describing to me, and you do see this in the Northeast, where there is, I think, more of a tradition of this kind of stuff. When the further west you go, the harder this kind of thing becomes. But you know, generally, when Philadelphia was first founded and grew, they wouldn't have called them micro apartments. They just would have called them homes. I mean, there was a lot of people who lived like this. They were Spartan kind of facilities, and that's what, you know, a lot of people had. We've raised the bar, and in a sense, we've priced out a lot of people, or created a huge burden on a certain, you know, groups of people to be in houses that meet kind of an acceptable middle class standard. We've set that through zoning and through finance law, and financing regulations. We've created these minimum standards that are way above and beyond what people actually either desire or would like. And we've also done this by, you know, excluding this kind of thing from certain neighborhoods. And so what you see is that where it's allowed and there's demand, it tends to pop up, but it also tends to be this kind of weird, at weird price points and for different kinds of people. I think a much more successful approach, and the approach that you see, you know, that would have been allowed pre-zoning, was people had what we would call today accessory apartments all over the place. You know, a very common thing would be to, you know, rent out your outbuilding as a, as another place. You know, the whole idea of like a bed and breakfast is a very modern thing. I mean, people, travelers on the road would often stop at whatever farmhouse was around or whatever home was there on the pet trail when dusk came. And they would pay the people there to, you know, allow them to stay in the barn or stay in another room. And then they'd, you know, feed them breakfast in the morning. And that was a very common way to do things. Now we're so obsessed about zoning and, you know, how we couldn't possibly have someone not related staying in a house overnight. You know, it's illegal in most parts of the country. We've created this like regulatory environment that doesn't allow that. And so you get these weird distortions where a whole segment of the market that where there's tons of demand, we're not allowed to meet that demand, except in these kind of odd places like you described with the micro apartment.
I think it's also interesting too that there's also some micro apartments in Philadelphia. I think it's near Northern Liberties, the more wealthier part of town. Yet at the same time, it's funny because I think both the prices, I haven't done a price check on this, but from what I think the prices are both the same of the micro apartments in Philadelphia and outside of Philadelphia in King of Prussia. So it's weird that it seems to me that wherever you decidingly go, it's like you have to pay almost the same price. Though I think what I looked at when I was looking at these things, I'm actually quite was interested. I think maybe King of Prussia was a little more expensive. These are possible.
Well, earlier I was actually looking at it was a King of Prussia mall on Google Maps, and one of the things that really stood out to me was the massive parking lot around it. There's kind of been talk about retrofitting those parking lots and turning them into like communities surrounding the malls.
It's funny because King of Prussia Mall, I think, might be up there with Mall of America. It's actually, if you're in Philadelphia, the second tourist attraction any foreigner goes to is the King of Prussia Mall. That's like in between Philadelphia. But the thing is, it's not Philadelphia. It's almost near the forest, like near Mount Pocono. And yet at the same time, there's this whole like sprawl happening, and like the micro apartments are right next to King of Prussia. So if you imagine living there, you just walk outside and your Commerce and convenience store is one of the nation's biggest malls. And then compared to like if you're in Northern Liberties in Philadelphia, well, if you have if you work in some office or some kind of wealthy, I don't know if there's a Google or an Apple in Philadelphia, but say some computer programming company, you walk from your micro apartment from there, you go there, you take a train, a bike, or whatever. But it seems to be, contrastingly, that these are two different, the demographics are the same. It seems like you have to be very wealthy to afford these areas of, and it kind of kicks the person out who's struggling to have interest in that. Now, I don't know, yeah. I find that interesting.
Well, I think a lot of what you're doing in those places, too, is you're displacing what you're seeing is that the traffic congestion and the inability to get, I mean, this is what you see at the Mall of America, you know, the inability to get anywhere during peak times really makes those places near the destination higher demand. And, you know, people are willing to pay higher prices. And so you see these things kind of start to crop up in places like that. Really, when we go to other parts of the system that have a lot of traffic congestion, instead of trying to deal with that traffic congestion by building more capacity, which is kind of our reflexive response, we really should be looking to changing our land use regulations and changing our financial approach so that we can get more of this type of thing so that people have other options other than to drive, really.
I know when it comes to the debate about zoning, like some people say zoning laws are good, and some people say they're bad. I know I interviewed Adam Hengels from Market Urbanism, and I think he goes as far as to advocate for abolishing zoning laws because he says that zoning laws are responsible for sprawl, and in many cases, he's absolutely correct because there's things like a mandatory parking requirements. And then there's an argument on the other side that zoning laws are necessary to prevent sprawl and to like preserve communities. But I think it's a lot more complex than that. I think you have to look at each zoning regulation on a case-by-case basis.
I've never seen a zoning ordinance that prevents sprawl, quite frankly.
What about green belts?
Point to one that's worked. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I see a lot of good intentions written.
In the Bay Area and even Southern California, to a degree, you have like state parks form as like a green belt.
But through zoning. I mean, if the government owns the property, it's one thing. If you're through zoning mandating, you know, I've seen out in Oregon where they have essentially the urban growth boundary, and the people there will argue strenuously, and I'm not gonna disagree with them. They will argue that all of that farmland would be developed with you know tract housing over and over and over if there wasn't the urban growth boundary. Okay, I'm not going to argue with that, and maybe the countryside would be developed. I can tell you that everything in the urban growth boundary, except for a very small percentage of stuff, is the junky stuff you see everywhere else across the U.S. So if the argument is it prevents, you know, what people call sprawl, to me, that's maybe it directs it to certain places, but it doesn't prevent it or contain it. You know, it doesn't reduce it. It maybe directs it to certain areas, but you still are building predominantly, even in a place like Portland, Oregon, that you're predominantly building in that fashion.
Yeah, that has happened in LA. Like a growth is being pushed out to places like the desert, like Palmdale, or in the Bay Area, it's being pushed out towards the Central Valley, and that creates a massive traffic. Then
right.
The other argument I've heard put out is like that's a disaster, but if there were no green belts, then the places like, say, closer to the Bay Area that are more scenic would have been developed instead. And even though those people would have been closer, those areas would have been ruined. So there's like these trade-offs.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the history of zoning came about for very logical reasons. I mean, we were in the Industrial Revolution. You had, uses next to each other that had not existed 100 years earlier. And the separation of uses in that case made a lot of sense. If we fast forward to today and look at modern zoning really is a kind of NIMBY enabling tool that allows people to oppose things that they don't like. It has far more of a negative, it's far more oppositional than it is, you know, allowing things. There's far more in a zoning code that you can't do than what you can. And one of the biggest problem we face right now from a land use perspective, from a transportation perspective as a country, is that we don't make very good use of the stuff we've already built. There is no mechanism to take a neighborhood of single family homes and turn it into duplexes. And by doing so, double the property values with no increase in expense. I mean, that's a productivity increase, and that's what our cities need to do. But right now, that's pretty much illegal in all parts of the country. And when people try to make it legal, people stand up and use the zoning codes.
And it would be a more incremental change than, say, going right from a single family home to zoning it for like 10 stories.
Well, I would think that is the wrong way to go about it, right? I mean, those huge skips. But I do think you give me the choice between the zoning codes we have today and no zoning, and I'm going to pick no zoning. You give me the choice between the zoning codes we have today and a code that essentially is obsessed with incremental development, not allowing the single family home to go to the 10-story condo, but allowing the next increment of growth. That's what I want. So I'm not against zoning. I think we need zoning that focuses on improving our financial productivity and allowing our cities to grow and adapt and change. I'll go back to the congestion one. You know, right now we have 70 years history of fighting congestion by adding more capacity. And we have 70 years of that not working. The way you deal with congestion is you allow building, you allow actually people to build. But we have this like goofy mindset that, oh, we've got congestion, so what we have to do is not allow people to build, because more people will mean more cars. Well, if you allow people to build, and they can build corner stores, and they can build restaurants, and they can build places for people to work, and they can build micro apartments and all those things, what you find is that neighborhoods start to develop. They start to become ecosystems, and you can deal with the congestion, or you can actually have an alternative to congestion that would, you know, get people essentially off the road and free up that capacity for people driving longer distances. This is not possible with our current zoning.
One point that you've made is that you talk about the fetishization of a density, and there's a lot of people in urbanism who have a strong proponents of density, and you're not saying that density is inherently bad, but I think you have to look at each community on a case-by-case basis. There's sort of good examples of density and bad examples of density, and the same can be said of low density. Like, for instance, if low density, obviously a bad example, would be an area of like your typical suburbia with those like massive parking lots in front of strip malls and single family tract housing on like one acre lots. And a good viable example of low density would be like a small town that's walkable and surrounded by wilderness. Then on the other hand, you can look at a high density. High density is successful in obviously a lot of European cities and cities like New York, San Francisco, Boston, the central part of Washington, D.C., where there is good public transportation and mass transit. And I think, I mean, you pointed out actually to Florida, where I really can't comment on that because I haven't been there. But L.A. is an example where you have a lot of parts of L.A. that are very dense, but at the same time, they're not really walkable. Though they're still very car-oriented, there's hardly any mass transit. You have these areas like of like lots of like six-story condominiums, and they're still car-oriented areas. So it really, I think you have to look at each community on a case-by-case basis. Density can be successful, but your point is that it shouldn't be fetishized just for the sake of it.
I think that planners specifically, the planning profession does have a fetish with density, and a lot of urban advocates do too. And to me, they treat density a lot like, you know, health people would treat calories. You know, you have a certain amount of calories every day and you shouldn't exceed this. And it's like, we have this obsessive focus on calories, but we all understand that, you know, if you're trying to stay under 2000 calories a day and, you know, you have 2000 calories of cheeseburgers and fries, that's a lot different than having 3,000 calories of fruits and vegetables. It's a vastly different thing. When you only focus on calories, you miss so much of the nuance. And I think planners, we in the literature and the research, we've drawn these correlations with density. And so all of a sudden, density becomes this thing that we can code. It becomes a thing that fits really nicely into the rubric of zoning that, you know, we love to use. It's like a tool that we can manage. And so what we do is we go out and we create all these density metrics in our zoning codes because, you know, density equals this, and we can actually code for that. And what we lose out on is what I would just call thinking, you know, all of the nuanced things that go on that actually make a place successful are just completely ignored because they're harder. They require you to think. They require you to get out on the street. They require you to actually have attention to detail. And it's much easier as planners to just have an arbitrary zoning or density metric. You know, I grew up on a farm in rural Minnesota, about the lowest density kind of development you can have. And financially, it was for the city was a great deal. How is that possible? Because it was so low density. Well, the road, you know, we had no sewer and water, right? The road in front of our place was like a two-tire path through the woods. When it snowed, you know, we get plowed out 2 days later. You know, we had very low levels of service. One of the problems we run into is where we have, you know, moderate densities, but extremely high levels of service. I think we have to get rid of the idea that that density is like a metric to hit, and start looking at it instead as like, you know, one of the outcomes of building a successful place.
So the different outcomes, there's like the financial sustainability, there's walkability, there's access to amenities, strong infrastructure, There's also aesthetics.
Yeah, I think, you know, to me, I feel like if planners focused, if they wanted to obsess about something, I think if they obsessed about the way buildings interacted with the public realm and the way buildings interacted with each other and quit obsessing over setbacks and density and use, but just, you know, made sure that everybody, every building that went in was a good neighbor. I think that it would be an enormous improvement overnight, really.
Can you give examples of places that are extremely dense but also successful at applying these principles?
You know, I can give like micro examples of it. You know, right by where I live, if you go to Fargo, North Dakota, In Fargo's downtown, they've actually done some incredible things from a coding standpoint and taken a downtown that, and no offense to Fargo, but 10 years ago was a junky kind of place, a place that I wouldn't have wanted to go, and made it into one of, I think, the great downtowns of the Midwest. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And they've really done it by having some great developers that understood what it was going to take to make the place work. And then also a kind of a culture of obsession, you know, obsession with detail. How do these buildings interact with the public realm? How do they interact with each other? How does the road and street design interact with all that? You can go to places like Louisville, Kentucky. You can go to Memphis, Tennessee, and you can see cities that have been down on their luck, but yet in certain parts of it have taken an approach fundamentally different, an approach about designing a place and has seen enormous rewards for it, have just seen, you know, things take off. You see other places like, and I'll pick on Omaha again. I really like Omaha, but, you know, Omaha is one of these places that I think has bounced from fad idea to fad idea. And what you see is that they come in, Kansas City is kind of the same way in many ways. They come in with the big kind of savior project that, you know, we're going to get it right this time. And they get a little bit of, you know, little bit of momentum, but never reach that kind of escape velocity where the thing starts to build on itself. And then a decade or two later, you have this project that cost a lot of money, but didn't really do what it was supposed to do. I think when you look at Louisville, Memphis, Fargo, and those kind of examples, what you see is a cultural shift followed by incremental development over time to build on successes. And I think that's the big delineation, I think, between the places that really do it well and the places that try but struggle.
Do you see places like San Francisco and Manhattan as viable places?
At the end of the day, yes. And I say yes because, and I explained this to a good friend of mine who lives in New York. You know, if cities across this country wind up getting forced into bankruptcy, which I think a lot of them will over the next decade or two, and you know, let's say New York and San Francisco are two of them, which I think they very well could be. If you wipe out the things that don't work financially about them and then you step back, what you find is that these cities have enormous amounts of wealth with very little comparative liabilities. So, for example, you go to the Empire State Building, and you say, okay, this is a building worth, I can't remember what it is, like $2.2 billion. You know, are the people who own that building going to have problems paying to fix the road and, you know, the street, the sidewalk, the pipe out in front of the building? No, they're not. They're going to do that because it is very logical. You go to the far outskirts of San Francisco, you know, you go to some of the Silicon Valley places where you just have suburban housing all over the place. And, you know, when the bubble bursts in those kind of places and, you know, the tech industry is not funneling all that money in and kind of elevating housing prices the way they are, are real property values going to justify going out and fixing all those miles of pipe and all those miles of street? I don't think so. So even if you, you know, have to deal with the pension crises and have to deal with some of these other things that we got ourselves into and we thought we would just grow forever, once those are worked out of the systems, places like San Francisco and New York, I think, are going to be in a strong financial position and really viable long term. Where
it's because they have qualities. It's not just, even though they're very dense, it's not so much just the density by itself. They have qualities about them that make them viable places to live, despite even if there was an economic problem. A place like the Silicon Valley, for instance, it's like semi-suburban, but it doesn't. They're not really investing on making it more walkable and more of a place people want to live, even though there's so much wealth there. And that places like that are not sustainable if the economy were to crash, because they don't have that desirability.
I agree. And I think, you know, Nassim Taleb, who is a writer and a thinker that I have drawn an enormous amount of inspiration for, he points out when it comes to literature, and I think the same thing goes to cities and building form, but he points out when it comes to literature that the books that have been around the longest, you can predict them being around longer than books that have been around only a short period of time. You know, the Bible is likely to be in print longer than Harry Potter, even though Harry Potter is selling more copies.
It's called fragility.
Well, anti-fragility, it's all part of the conversation. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, is the idea is that systems that gain from stress over time tend to persist. And so, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey are likely to be read 2,000 years from now. Harry Potter, not nearly as likely, even though Harry Potter is a fantastic series and everybody today loves it. When you look at cities, a city like New York, a city like San Francisco, that are built on more kind of timeless frameworks and timeless principles, are more likely to be around and be successful, you know, 100 years from now, than a thing like Silicon Valley, which is very young, very new, and built on a kind of this new framework that really has not stood the test of time. So just from a anti-fragility standpoint, you have a lot more going on in New York and San Francisco than you do in other parts of the country.
What do you think about the movement to kind of retrofit suburbia and to take like these parking lots and turn them into these walkable communities? Are there strong zoning barriers preventing that from happening? I know there's even been a book called Retrofitting Suburbia.
Yeah, there has been. And I not to denigrate any of that work, because I think it's important, and I think the people that are doing it are brilliant, and I think they're doing, you know, I think that the mental effort that has gone into putting that stuff together is astounding. That being said, I think it's more cute than anything else. And I do think at the end of the day, the vast expanse of suburbia that would need to be retrofitted just makes this not a scalable strategy. You know,
I do see it in like wealthier suburbs especially, but I don't see it happening in working class or middle class suburbs.
I think you're right, but in wealthier suburbs, they only want to do it with other wealthy people. And that's not really a viable strategy either. And I'm not talking about it from an equity standpoint. I'm talking about it from, you know, or a social justice standpoint. I'm just talking about it from a financial standpoint. I mean, you can't have an agglomeration of all wealthy people and expect that place to do well over the long term. It doesn't work that way. So you look at these places that are wealthy that are doing this suburban retrofit. And all these places, you know, people still want their two cars. They still want the big parking lots. They still want all that stuff. They just essentially want like downtown Disney too. And, you know, that may work in a few areas, but, you know, there's not enough people in this country to make productive use of every rundown mall parking lot. You know, if we decided today that we were going to do this on a grand scale, you would need to increase the population of the country by, you know, 10, 20 times to fill all of that space.
It's funny you mention that, because usually I hear people complaining that we're too overpopulated and there's not enough room for housing.
Well, if we took the population of the U.S. and had it over, you know, had it over time evolve to ways that would be financially viable, you know, land use patterns that we could actually sustain financially over the long term, we would be occupying 10%, 20% of the land area that we occupy right now. You know, we're spread out by 70, 80% more than what we can actually financially pay for. And you see this in places like Detroit, where there's this contraction going on and neighborhoods that are in terminal decline and being walked away from. You're starting to see it in other cities too, kind of in the earlier, you know, earlier stages of this. Our cities are going to geographically contract over the next generation and become a lot smaller than they are today. And that's just a math problem. You know, that's not, and that's something that suburban retrofit.
By contract, you mean being smaller and more compact and dense?
You use the dense word again. I think density will be like a byproduct of it. I tend to talk about it in terms of, you know, what can we maintain? You go back, we have some cities that we've studied where you go back to 1945 and there'll be 8 foot of water pipe per person. So a family of four will have 32 feet of water pipe in the ground on average throughout the city. The same city now today, it's 200 feet of pipe per person. So all of a sudden, a family of four has 800 feet of pipe. Well, you know, pipe is laid by the foot. It's a couple hundred dollars a foot for water pipe. It's going to be another couple hundred for sewer pipe. There's just not enough wealth there being generated for a family to maintain that much stuff. And so what will happen is that we will go back to levels and ratios that actually make some sense. And that means that a lot of the pipe will never be fixed. A lot of the roads will go away. They won't be fixed. And you will wind up living, if you want to say more compactly or in higher density, I would describe it as you're going to be living in neighborhoods instead of spread out across the countryside.
If you take like a city like Vegas, for instance, I could see in the future that a lot of these tract housing developments that they've been building in the last couple decades eventually being abandoned and turned back to open desert, and seeing like more compact development along the strip. I mean, some of those Sunbelt cities are totally not viable at all. And in the case of Vegas, because they have a strong economy based on tourism, I could see it becoming like smaller in size, but more concentrated around the main like downtown and strip areas.
Yeah, I think you see that out west. I think you even out east are going to see this too. I mean, we've created these, what Richard Florida calls these mega regions, which is essentially, you know, the cities kind of smeared out across the landscape. And I think a lot of that smeared out across the landscape area is going to itself like coalesce into what in the past would have been called villages or towns. As opposed to having, you know, all that space in between occupied, because it's the space in between that makes no financial sense.
So you know, in a sense, the future will be kind of like the past. We'll have people living in compact cities or small towns, but we'll see a decline in the whole sort of a suburban car model.
Yeah, and I think that's just a math problem. I mean, that's not I'm not sitting here like wishing people would live in urban villages, and so I predict that it will happen. I actually was the other way. I mean, I was the guy out building the highway development and the frontage roads and the strip malls and all that stuff, and I just said, like, this doesn't make any financial sense. This is not going to be here two generations from now. It can't be maintained. And so the simple math says that we're going to have to live in ways – I mean, look – we're the richest country in the world. I mean, we are so affluent beyond compare, and we can't maintain, I mean, our sidewalks, our crosswalks. We can't keep fire departments staffed and police departments, you know, up to staff. We are going to have to contract to a viable amount of expense in order to make this thing work. And that's, like I said, just a math problem.
One reason infrastructure is so expensive is often the government borrows that money from private banks instead of having their own state-run bank, like a lot of countries like China have.
Yes. I mean, I think you could also argue that, you know, the way government spends on infrastructure has created a lot of price inflation. You know, we look at the medical sector today and see the medical sector costs going up at many multiples of inflation. And we kind of understand, you know, the same with universities, that, you know, when there's a lot of money put into something, it drives up the cost. I mean, that's kind of economics 101. The same thing happens in construction. When there's a lot of demand, which there has been, for building materials and construction, the cost of all of it goes up. And we really don't have a, we have a competitive environment in some sense, but not a competitive environment where we're competing to drive down costs. We're competing to get contracts, and it's a very different kind of undertaking. So yeah, I think the way we build this stuff, you know, we as engineers tell ourselves building, you know, 20 miles of pipe or 20 miles of road at a time, as opposed to 1 mile or 2 miles instead of two blocks, is more efficient. And so you get a lower per unit cost. And that is true from a pure engineering standpoint. What we don't look at and calculate is that when you build it, it becomes a sunk cost. And now your incentive to wring as much value out of it as you can goes away. And so our overall productivity drops. Cities in prior times, before we were so affluent, had to build slowly and incrementally. And it cost a lot more to build stuff because you were building it really slowly. I mean, you get a pipe crew out to lay a block.
What about the transcontinental rail?
I think, and you can look at the interstates in a lot of the same ways too. The value of the transcontinental railroad and the value of the interstates was in connecting places. And those have value today. I mean, the rail system has immense value. The interstate highway system has immense value in connecting places across great distance. The difference is, and what I'm really talking about in terms of wealth, is what happens within those places once they're connected. You know, if you look at a place like Paris and said, okay, we ran the railroads to the edge of Paris, and then you got the metro in the, you know, underground in the middle of it, you still have all this wealth that is Paris. But if you had run the railroads right through the middle of it and torn down the city to do it, and, you know, torn down the city to put highway through the middle of it, you would have the transportation.
So this kind of ties back with what we were saying with the Roman aqueducts. Those cities like Paris, they did that when they were already major cities.
Yeah.
Massive infrastructure projects planning on maybe on some future hypothetical city.
Exactly. When we have nostalgized this notion of build it and they will come. And that works really well if you're an advocate for more infrastructure. I mean, if you get paid to build more infrastructure, build it and they will come is really attractive as a mindset. But if you're the person who has to make productive use of it, once it's built, it's a sunk cost. And so the incentive to wring every ounce of value out of it just goes away. I've seen cities where they had the pipe in the ground. They had millions of dollars of infrastructure in the ground. And you know, the developer comes down and says, I want to build storage sheds here. And you're like, storage sheds? What are you talking about? They don't create any tax base. They don't use your infrastructure, so they're not going to pay you for the sewer and water. They don't employ anyone. What benefit does this have? But yet the city will say, well, it's better than nothing. I mean, right now we got nothing there, and this is better than nothing, so let's do it. And I've seen that so many times as just kind of like the epitome of the sunk cost problem.
What do you think about the debate between the balance between the private and the public sector? Some people say privatize everything. Well, some people say that the public sector should control most things. And this obviously ties in with what we were talking about, like infrastructure.
Yeah. To me, I don't draw the distinction that way. To me, I would draw the distinction like this. I think all risk should be in the private sector. And I think things that involve no risk or very, very low risk should be in the public sector.
This ties into things like the bailout of Wall Street.
Yeah, very much so. I think conceptually you can apply it in the same way. But if you're a city right now, cities take on enormous amounts of risk all the time. Developer will come in, have a piece of property, say, I will put in the roads and the streets and the sewer and the water. And then you, the city, take over the maintenance of it. And then I'll go out and, you know, build the homes. We'll sell off the lots. And cities are like, yeah, we'll take that risk. And maybe the city will even finance the infrastructure for you because they want the growth, right? But, you know, they're taking on the risk. The problem is that the developer at that point has no need or no necessity to actually create enough tax base to actually be able to afford to maintain that pipe. The city's taking on that liability. And, you know, this is where cities... Right now, cities today take on enormous amounts of risk and they're not even aware that they're doing it. They actually think they're being very conservative. And this is where the notion of conservative, you know, and progressive or liberal are all messed up in this country. Because, you know, at the local level, our city should be really hyper-conservative or hyper unwilling to take on risk, because they are essentially stewards of the public purse. And if that were the case, we'd have a dramatically different approach than we do today. You know, cities would not undertake and not allow to be undertaken, you know, 90%+ of what they do today. It just wouldn't be allowed.
What do you see as the role of government in historic preservation and also wilderness preservation and the environment?
My kind of cynical sense is that, you know, you have the left hand of government fighting the right hand of government. So you have this natural reaction of historic preservation, which I get and I in many ways applaud. You also have this natural reaction of trying to preserve natural open space and wilderness areas and what have you. And I applaud that too. I get it. But on the other side, you've got, you know, the federal government subsidizing mortgages, subsidizing horizontal expansion of cities, pumping, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars into highway construction and bridge construction and all the things that actually make the other side necessary. If we weren't doing the subsidies of the bad development, we wouldn't have nearly the pressure to have to, you know, rescue all the other stuff. And so I kind of feel like, you know, we create our own problems and then we solve them. And I wish we would just stop creating the problems.
I found this really curious about housing. I think we live in also a generation too where you wish there could be more families, or that, you know, a young 20-something-year-old, probably late or mid-20s, could marry his, you know, girlfriend or wife and start a family. And they start a young family and have like 3 kids in a place. But the problem is they can't really find a house, because you got to be wealthy to have a house and you got to have money to do all this stuff. And so really it's allowed for the upper classes to have families, and the lower classes have to like stagnate and wait until their late 30s, get married, have a single child, live in an okay place, not in a wealthy part, and then depending upon what that income is, you know. And that's kind of hurting the whole family formation, and all these difficulties are happening. It seems to me that if you were to able to make housing more, you know, I guess affordable or closer by, would there be an increase in maybe a new baby boom that would happen between a younger generation? I don't think the millennials will, but maybe the next generation after millennials, could there be a possible future baby boom if there were towns more fitted together or closer and cheaper?
It's a very interesting hypothesis. And I think that you're right in the sense that I think the economics of our time are changing the dynamics of family formation. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, I'm 43, so I'm kind of snug in the middle of that group. I've got a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. I probably followed what in prior generations would be a traditional way of going about doing things. I see my younger cousins and nieces taking a very different path and kind of delaying a lot of those things. And if you dig into it, you know, some of it is it's culturally acceptable now to delay. I mean, my parents were on my case at age 22. You know, when are you gonna have kids? You know, you don't get that as much today. But I think also, you know, for them, a lot of it is economics, right? Like, we're not ready to have a family. We are not financially secure enough to have a family. I do think that what we have done with our approach to development, and it is largely an approach based around, I think you're right, the affluent or the middle class or the upper middle class and their wants and needs. What we have done is we have made working class people very financially insecure. There was a study I saw a while back that, you know, most people in this country, if they got a $400 bill, could not afford to pay it. Like that would not be in their financial means. And when you step back and you think about how affluent we are as a country, that is a bizarre notion, right? Like that, mm-hmm. that should not happen in a country like this. Mm-hmm. It's happened because we've made this whole generation really fragile. If we could do things to make that less so, you know, give people more opportunity to feel secure in their place, give people, you know, have less of a burn rate to have to live in a neighborhood. So if you could have one car instead of two or zero cars instead of one, you know, to be able to live and have a job and be productive. Well, now all of a sudden we've lowered your burn rate and you could feel financially more secure. If we could start to do some of those things, I do think that maybe it would have an impact. And people, you know, people will put off having kids when they're not feeling secure. And if we could change that, I think you're right. I think it may have the impact that you're kind of putting forward as a theory.
Mm-hmm. We are at the end of the show. Charles Marone, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate the opportunity to chat, and I hope everybody got a lot out of it.
And also, thanks, Billiter.
It's nice talking to you, Charles. Really cool.
Hey, thanks so much.